Blog Talk Radio.
Cheated by spectral jokes and waking studies.
suddenly with ghastly laughter, to be rebuked by the cold, lonely, silent midnight, and to rake with confusion and numbery among the gibbering nonsense to find the motive of this contemptible castination. Dreams are jealous of being remembered. They dissipate instantly and angrily if you try to hold them. When newly awakened from lively dreams, we are so near them, still agitated by them, still in their sphere. Give us one syllable, one feature, one hint, and we should repossess the whole. Hours of the strange entertainment would come trooping back to us. We cannot get our hand on the first link or fiber, and the whole is lost. There is a strange willfulness in the sea's speed with which it disperses and baffles our grasp. A dislocation seems to be the foremost trait of dreams. A painful imperfection almost always tells them, attends them. The faith that the fairest forms, the most noble and excellent persons, are deformed by some pitiful and insane circumstance. The very landscape and scenery in a dream seem not to fit us, but like a coat or cloak of some other person to overlap and encumber the wearer. So is the ground and the road and the house in dreams too long or too short, and if it served no other purpose would show us how accurately nature fits man awake. There was one memory of waking and another of sleep. In our dreams, the same scenes and fantasies are many times associated, and that too, it would seem, for years. In sleep, one shall travel certain roads and stagecoaches or gigs, which he recognizes as familiar, and has dreamed that ride a dozen times, or shall walk alone in familiar fields and meadows with roads, or which meadow in waking hours he never looked upon. This feature of dreams deserves the more attention from its singular resemblance to that obscure yet startling experience which almost every person confesses in daylight, that particular passages of conversation and action are occurred to him in the same order before, whether dreaming or waking, a suspicion that they have been with precisely these persons in precisely this room and heard precisely this dialogue at some former hour, they know not when. Annals have been called the dreams of date of nature. Perhaps for a conception of their consciousness, we may go to our own dreams. In a dream, we have the instinctive obedience, the same torpidity of the highest power, the same unsurprised descent to the monstrous as these metamorphosized men exhibit. Our thoughts in a stable or in a menagerie, on the other hand, may well remind us of our dreams. What in compassion do these imprisoning forms awaken? You may catch the glance of a dog sometimes that lays a kind of claim to sympathy and brotherhood. What, somewhat of me down there? Does he know it? Can he too, as I go, of himself, see himself, perceive relations? We fear lest the poor brute should gain one dreadful glimpse of his condition, and should learn in some moment the tough limitations of this fettering organization. It was in this glance that Ovid got the hint of the metamorphosis, Caledissa, of his transmigration of souls. For these fables are our own thoughts carried out, and what keeps those wild tales in circulation for thousands of years? What but the wild fact to which they suggest some approximation of theory? Nor is the fact quite solitary, for in varieties of our own species, our organizations seem to predominate over the genius of man. In Kalmuk or Malay or Flathead Indian, we are sometimes pained by the same feeling. And sometimes, too, the sharp-witted, prosperous, white man awakens it. In a mixed assembly, we have chance to see not only a glance of Abdiel, who so grand and keen, but also in other faces the features of the mink or the bull or the rat or the barn door fowl. You think, could the man overlook his own condition? He could not be restrained from suicide. I don't know, between you and I, this is bizarre stuff, but, you know, I think old Ralph was using some kind of stimulant when he was writing this, because there's no question in my mind, I mean, this is an opium, this seems to be like an opium-laced essay, you know? And because the levels of his writing to me are so very inspired, they're fourth dimensional, they're trans-dimensional. You know, that's essentially trans-dimensionalists, if you will. You have to understand what that is. And what it is talking in fourth dimensional concepts. You know, using a third dimensional vehicle. I guess that's what we're doing. With words. Dreams have a poetic integrity and truth. Now, I want to go back, and for those of you who might have just joined me, I'm reading from an essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson entitled Demonology. And I just mentioned, I find that, you know, it's absolutely fascinating to read this, but you can see that he himself is writing this from a dream, you know, from a fourth dimensional level of stream, if you will, consciousness. Because there's no question about it, you know, and I'll continue reading this, because he's understanding demonology, but he's going into what that fourth dimensional state is, and he's bringing it right there so, you know, you can see it. Dreams have a poetic integrity and truth. This limbo and dust hole of thought is presided over by a certain reason to. Their extravagance from nature is yet within a higher nature. They seem to us to suggest an abundance and fluency of thought not familiar to the waking experience. They pick us by independence of us. Yet we know ourselves in this mad crowd and owe to dreams a kind of divination and wisdom. My dreams are not me. They are not nature, nor the not me, they are both. They have a double consciousness, at one sub and objective. We call the phantoms that rise the creation of our fancy, but they act like mutineers and fire on their commander, showing that every act, every thought, every cause is bipolar, and in the act is contained the counteraction. If I strike, I am struck. If I chase, I am pursued. Why isn't sometimes terrible hints shall in them be thrown to man out of a quite unknown intelligence? He shall be startled two or three times in his life by the justice as well as the significance of this phantasmagoria. Once or twice the conscious fetters shall seem to be unlocked and the freer utterance attained. Prophetic character in all ages has haunted them. They are the maturation often of opinions, not consciously carried out statements, but whereof we already possess the elements. Thus, when awake, I know the character of Rupert, but do not think what he may do. In dreams, I see him engaged in certain actions which seem preposterous, of all fitness. He is hostile, he is cruel, he is frightful, he is a poltroon, that turns prophecy a year later. But it was already in my mind, his character, and the Sibyl dreams merely embodied it in fact. Why, then, should not symptoms auguries, forebodings be, and as one said, the moaning of the spirit? I don't know what this guy was smoking, boy, but I'll tell you, he was out there. We are led by this experience into the high region of cause, and acquainted with the identity of very unlike-seeming effects. We learn that actions whose turpitude is very differently rebuked proceed from one and the same affection. Sleep takes off the costume of circumstance, arms us with terrible freedom. For that every will rushes to a deed. A skillful man reads his dreams for his self-knowledge, yet not the details, but the quality. What part does he play? What part does B play in them? A cheerful, manly beat part, a cheerful, manly part, or a poor, dribbling part? However monstrous and grotesque their apparition, they are a substantial truth. The same remark shall be extended to the omens and coincidences which may have astonished us. Of all, it is true that the reason of them, is always latent in the individual. Goethe said, "These whimsical pictures, inasmuch as they originate from us, may well have an analogy with our whole life and fate." Now, you know, these guys are all heavy opium users. I didn't know that. I wasn't aware that Emerson was, but boy, I'll tell you, based on the way he's writing here, I definitely think he was using some of them. We are led by this experience into a high region. I just read that, I'm sorry. The soul contains in itself the event that shall presently befall it. For the event is only the actualizing of its thoughts. It is no wonder that particular dreams and presentiments should fall out and be prophetic. The fallacy consists in selecting a few insignificant hints when all are inspired with the same sense. As if one should exhaust his astonishment of the economy of his thumbnail and overlook the essential causal miracle of his being a man. And every man goes through the world attended with innumerable facts prefiguring, yes, distinctly announcing his fate. If only eyes of sufficient heed and illumination were fastened on the sign is always there, if only the eye were also. Just as under every tree in the speckled sunshine and shade, no man notices that every spot of light is a perfect image of the sun, until in some hour the moon eclipses the luminary, and then first we notice that the spots of the light become crescents or annular and correspond to the changed figure of the sun. And things are significant enough, heaven knows. But the seer of the sign, where is he? We doubt not a man's fortune may be read in the lines of his hand by palmistry, in the lines of his face by physiognomy, and in the outlines of the skull by craniology. And the lines are all there, but the reader waits. The long waves indicate to the instructed mariner that there is no near land in the direction from which they came. And Belzoni describes the three marks which led him to dig for a door to the Pyramid of Giza. And he said, what thousands had beheld the same spot for so many ages and seen no three marks. Secret analogies tie together the remotest part of nature. As the atmosphere of a summer morning is filled with innumerable gossamer threads, running in every direction, revealed by the beams of the sun, of the rising sun. All night, all life, all creation is telltale and betraying. A man reveals himself in every glance and step and movement. I'm going to read that again. That last, those last three lines. It's paragraph. It's one paragraph, but it really grabbed you. Grabbed me. Secret analogies tie together the remotest parts of nature. As the atmosphere of a summer morning is filled with innumerable gossamer threads running in every direction, revealed by the beams of the rising sun. All life, all creation is telltale and betraying. A man reveals himself in every glance, step, head with foot, bath, private, and amity. Head with foot, bath, private, amity. Both with moons and tides. It's a quote from someplace. Not a mathematical axiom, but in a moral rule. The jest and byword to an intelligent ear extends its meaning to the soul and to all time. Indeed, all productions of men or man are so
shocks, but
but by infinite graduations, so that we live embosomed in sounds we do not hear, scents we do not smell, spectacles we do not see, and by innumerable impressions so softly laid on the thought important, we do not discover them until our attention is called to them. For Spiritism, it shows that no man almost is fit to give evidence. When I say to the amiable and sincere among them, these matters are quite too important than that I can rest them on any legends. If I have no facts, as you allege, I can very well wait for them. I am content and occupied with such miracles as I know, and such as my heart and ears daily show me, such as humanity and astronomy. If any others are important to me, they will certainly be shown to me. In times most credulous of these fancies, their sense was always met and the superstition rebuked by this grave spirit of reason and humanity. When Hector is told that the omens are unpropitious, he replies, "One omen is the best to fight for one's country." And Euripides said, "He is not the best prophet who guesses well, and he is not the wisest man whose guess turns out well in the event. But he who, whatever the event be, takes reason and probability for his guide. Swans, horses, dogs, and dragons," says Plutarch, we distinguished as sacred and vehicles of the divine foresight. And yet we cannot believe that men are sacred and favorite of heaven. The poor shipmaster discovered a sound theology when in the storm of sea, he made his prayer to Neptune, "O God, thou mayest save me if thou wilt, and if thou wilt not, mayest destroy me. But however, I will hold my rudder true." And let me add one more example of the same good sense. In a quote, a story quote out of Hectarius of Abdera. This is so interesting, man. This is the quote from Hectarius of Abdera. "As I was once traveling by the Red Sea, there was one among the horsemen that attended us named Mazulam, a brave and strong man, and according to the testimony of all the Greeks and barbarians, a very skillful archer. Now while the whole multitude was on the way, an ogre called out to them to stand still, and this man inquired the reason of their halting. The ogre showed him a bird and told him, if that bird remained where he was, it would be better for them all to remain. If he flew on, they might proceed, but if he flew back, they must return. The Jew said nothing, but bent his bow and shot the bird to the ground. This act offended the ogre and some others, and they began to utter imprecations against the Jew. But he replied, 'Wherefore, why are you so foolish as to take care of this unfortunate bird? How could this fowl give us any wise directions representing our journey, when we could not save his own life? Had he known anything of futurity, he would not have come here to be killed by the arrow of Muslim the Jew.' It is not the tendencies of our time to ascribe importance to whimsical pictures of sleep or to omens. But the faith in particular, or in peculiar and alien powers, takes another form in the modern mind, much more resembling the ancient doctrines of the guardian genius. The belief that particular individuals are attended by a good fortune which makes them desirable associates in any enterprise of uncertain success exists not only among those who take part in political and military projects, but influences all joint action of commerce and affairs, and a corresponding assurance in the individual so distinguished meets and justifies the expectations of others by a boundless self-trust. "I have a lucky hand, sir," said Napoleon to his hesitating chancellor. "And those on whom I lay it are fit for anything. And this faith is familiar in one form, that often a certain abdication of prudence and foresight is an element of success, that child and young persons come off safe from casualties that would have proved dangerous to wiser people. We do not think the young will be forsaken, but he is fast approaching the age when the sub-miraculous eternal protection and leading are withdrawn, and he is committed to his own care. The young man takes a leap into the dark and a light safe. As he comes into manhood, he remembers passages and persons that seem, as he looks at them now, to have been supernaturally deprived of injurious influence on him. His eyes were holden that he could not see, but he learns that such risks he may no longer run, and he observes with pain not that he incurs mishap here and there, but that his genius, whose invisible benevolence was tower and shield to him, is no longer present and active. In the popular belief, ghosts are a selecting tribe, avoiding millions, speaking to one. In our traditions, fairies, angels, and saints show the like favoritism. So do these agents and the means of magic as sorcerers and amulets. This faith is a doubting power, or rather a doubting power, so easily sliding into the current belief everywhere, and in the particular lucky days and fortunate persons, as frequent in America today as the faith in incantations and filters was in Rome, or the one some potency of the sign of the cross in modern Rome, this supposed power runs athwart the recognized agencies, natural and moral, which science and religion explore. Heed, though it may be in many actions and partnerships, it is not the power to which we build churches to make liturgies and prayers, or which we regard in passing law or found college professorships to expound. Goethe has said in his anthology or autobiography that it is much to the purpose. States that I believe that I discovered in nature animate and inanimate, intelligent and brute, somewhat which manifested itself only in contradiction, and therefore could not be grasped by a conception, much less by a word. It was not godlike, since it seemed unreasonable, not human, since it was not understanding, not devilish, since it was benevolent or beneficent, not angelic, since it is often a marplot. It resembled chance, since it showed no sequel. It resembled providence, since it pointed at connection. All which limits us seems permeable to that. It seems to deal at pleasure with the necessary elements of our constitution. It shortened time and extended space. Only in the impossible it seemed to delight, and the possible to repel with contempt. This, which seemed to insert itself between all other things, to sever them, to bind them, I named the demoniacal, after the example of the ancients, of those who had observed the like. Oh, God. I'd like to do right now, if you don't mind, I'd kind of like to just take a quick break. Here's a break. Gather my thoughts a little bit on this. If like me, you're like, what the hell is he talking about? I'm not really quite sure. I want to review this again in case I could clarify this. And when I come back, so just enjoy the music for a little while. I like this song. It's called Swagger. And it's a little bluesy tune. I'll be right back after this.
Phenomena which hence originates there
countless names, since all philosophies and religions have attempted in prose or in poetry to solve this riddle and to settle the thing once and for all, and indeed they may be allowed to do. But this demonic element appears more fruitful when it shows itself as the determining characteristic in an individual. In the course of my life, I have been able to observe several such from near and some farther off. They are not always superior persons, either in mind or in talent. They seldom recommend themselves through goodness of heart, but a monstrous force goes out from them, and they exert an incredible power over all creatures, and even over the elements. Who shall say how far such an influence can extend? All united moral powers avail nothing against them. In vain do the clever-headed part of the mankind discredit them as deceivers or deceived, and the mass is attracted. Seldom or never do they meet their match among their contemporaries. They are not to be conquered save by the universe itself, and against which they have taken up arms. And out of such experiences, doubtless, arose the strange, monstrous proverb, nobody against God but God. And it would be easy in the political history of every time to furnish examples of this irregular success. Men having a force which, without virtue, without shining talent, yet making them prevailing, makes them prevailing. No equal appears in the field against them. Power goes out from them, which draws all men and events to favor them. The crimes they commit, the exposures which follow, and which would ruin any other man, are strangely overlooked, or do not strangely turn to their account, or do more strangely turn to their account. I set down these things as I find them, but I, however poetic these twilights of thought, I like daylight, and I find somewhat willful some play at blind man's bluff, and when men as wise as Goethe talk mysteriously of demonology, the insinuation is that the known eternal laws of morals and matters are sometimes corrupted or evaded by this gypsy principle, which chooses favorites and works in the dark of their behoof. And as if the laws of the Father of the universe were sometimes balked and eluded by a meddlesome aunt of the universe for her pets. Who will observe that this extends the popular idea of success to the very gods, and they foster a success to you, which is not a success at all? Is a midsummer madness corrupting all who hold the tenet? The demonologic is only a fine name for egotism, an exaggeration, namely, of the individual, whom it is nature's settled purpose to postpone. There is one word, one world common to all who are awake, but each sleeper betakes himself to one of his own. Dreams retain the infirmities of our character. The good genius may be there or not. Our evil genius is sure to stay. The ego, partial makes the dream, and the ego total the interpretation. Life is also a dream on the same terms. I'm not really sure where he's going with this. You know, There are many things of which wise men might wish to be ignorant. And these are such. Shun them as you would the secrets of the undertaker and the butcher. The best are never demonical or magnetic. Leave this limbo to the prince of the power of the air. The lowest angel is better. It is the height of the animal. Allah are below the region of the divine. Power as such is not known to angels. Great men feel that they are so by sacrificing their selfish and falling back on what is humane, renouncing family, clan, country, and each exclusive and local connection to beat with the pulse and breathe with the lungs of nations. A Highland chief, an Indian sachem, or a feudal baron may fancy that the mountains and the lakes are made specially for him. Donald, or him, Tecumseh, the one question for history is the pedigree of his house, and the future age will be busy with this renown, and he has a guardian angel, that he is not the role of common men, but obeys the high family destiny. When he acts unheard of, success evinces the presence of rare agents, and what is to befall him. Omens and coincidences foreshadow. When he dies, banshees will announce his fate to kinsmen in foreign parts. And what more facile than to project that exuberant selfhood into the regions where individuality is forever bound by generic and cosmical laws? The deepest flattery, and that to which we can never be insensible, is the flattery of omens. And for some reason, I'm just this is so much different than some of his other works, which seem to be more better framed. You know, these ideas are much better framed than the normal. But these are so scattered. It's very, or else my mind right now is so scattered. It's very, very difficult to condense a thought pattern that isn't disconnected or disjointed at this point after reading this. From what I'm getting, you know, it's really a praise of sleep, you know, or a player praise of the subconscious. But, you know, demonology is that preying upon the man's dark curiosity, you know, and need to know the future. I do tarot readings. I mean, I know what this is about, and I, you know, but I'm and I've read so much of occult literature. Occult works that I'll read them right here on the air, and you know that these things don't really frighten me like they did many years ago. Like Emerson said here, you are your demon. You know what I mean? You are the demon. You are the occult. This is all part of you. All knowledge. But like you said, it's the knowledge that you'd rather not know, like the secrets of the butcher or the secrets of a surgeon or whatever, you know. Just rather not know. You'd rather not see it. You know it, but you'd rather not see it performed. It's no different than when I had surgery last year. I didn't want want to see it. I didn't want to see anything of it. I just wanted the pain to go away after it happened. So, you know, and even then, just, you know, the thought of looking at it, just did not want, I didn't want to go through that. So, you know, I had to ignore it. And by my ignoring it, believe it or not, it did go away. You know, by ignoring the negativity of it, by ignoring the ugliness of it, or ignoring the fright of it, or whatever, I simply ignored that. I ignored them like demons and just walked away from it. And I healed within a miraculous time. And, you know, I'm here today, which was a miracle in itself, I guess. But, Those kind of incidences change your attitude a bit toward faith, God, toward your purpose, you know, in life, toward your legacy, if you will. What kind of, how will you be remembered? Or does it even matter? I'd rather have it all in writing. Emerson did. Have somebody trying to figure it out. Then have it on my website. You know, have everything that I do written, thought about, you know, is there to be reviewed. So by the public. And basically, that's where this leads me. Coincidences, dreams, animal magnetism. You run into this twilight and say there's more than is dreamed of in your philosophy. Certainly these facts are interesting and deserve to be considered. And this is not the least remarkable fact that the adepts have developed. Men who have been wandering, men who have never wondered at anything, who had thought it the most natural thing in the world that they should exist in this orderly and replenished world, have been unable to suppress their amazement at the disclosures of the somnambulist, the particularly of the history of animal magnetism, is that it drew in its inquirers and students a class of persons never on any occasion known as students and inquirers. Of course, the inquiry is pursued on low principles. Animal magnetism peeps. It becomes in such hands a black art. And the use of the thing, the commodity, the power at once conic to mind and direct to the course of inquiry. It seems to open again the door which was opened to the imagination of childhood of magicians and fairies and lamps of Aladdin, the traveling cloaks and the cloak and the shoes of swiftness and the sword of sharpness that were to satisfy the uttermost wish of the senses without danger to a drop of sweat. But as nature can never be outwitted, as in the universe no man was ever known to get a sense worth without paying in some form or other the cent, so this prodigious promiser ends always and always will, as sorcerer and alchemy, as sorcery and alchemy have done before, in very small and smoky performances. Mesmerism is high life below stairs. Mama's playing Jove in the kitchens of Olympus. Tea is low curiosity or lust of structure, and is separated by celestial diameters from the love of the spiritual truth. It is wholly a false view to couple these things in any manner with the religious nature and sentiment, and the most dangerous superstitions to raise them to the lofty place of the motives and sanctions. This is to prefer halos and rainbows to the sun and moon. mistakenly, flatulency, a mistaken flatulency for inspiration, were this drivel, which they report as the voice of spirits, really such, we must find out the more decisive suicide, I say to the table rappers. I will believe thou will not utter what thou dost not know, and so far I will trust thee, Angel Kate. They are ignorant of all that is healthy and useful to know, and by laws of kind, dunces seeking dunces in the dark of what they call the spiritual world, preferring more snores and gastric noises to the voice of any muse. I think the rappings a new test, like blue litmus or other chemical absorbent, to try catechism with. It detects organic skepticism in the very heads of the church. This is the lawless world. We have left the geometry and passion, the coincidence of the daily whatever. I've kind of lost myself here. This goes on quite further, and I'm a little bit, more than a little bit, I guess I'm meantime, far be from me the impatience which cannot brook the supernatural, the vast. Far be from me the lust of explaining away all the which appeals to the imagination, the great presentiments which haunt us. Willingly, I too say, hail to the unknown awful powers which transcend the ken of the understanding, and the attraction which this topic has had for me, and with which induces me to unfold its parts. For you is precisely because I think the numberless forms in which this superstition are reappeared in every time and every peoples indicates the indistinguishableness of wonder in man, betrays his conviction that behind all your explanations is a vast and potent and living nature, inexhaustible and sublime, which you cannot explain. He is sure no book, no man has told him all. He is sure the great instinct, the circumambient soul that flows into him and into all and is his life has not been searched. He is sure the intimate relationship subsists between his character and his fortune, between him and his world, and until he can adequately tell them, he will tell them wildly and fabulously. Demonology is the shadow of theology. The whole world is an omen and a sign. Why look so wistfully in a corner? Man is the image of God. Why run after a ghost or a dream? The voice of divination resounds everywhere and runs to waste unheard, unregarded, is unheard, unregarded, as the mountain echoes with the bleating of cattle. So, you know, saying stay away from it, folks, if you can. I, on the other hand, have delved into it, came out of it alive, and, seen quite a bit of weird shit, but, and studied a lot of weird stuff. But I trust Emerson. But man, if anybody's been flying around there or that, he was flying around in that essay. Wait. But I thank him for that. And I thank everybody who put up with that tonight and listened to it. And you can get that by rwe.org. That's the Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson. And that's the complete works of Ralph Waldo Emerson, by the way. A tremendous website resource. And that was given to me by a scholar as well, I think. But anyway, good luck. And I want to thank everyone for joining me tonight. Have a pleasant weekend. I won't be around tomorrow. Have a nice weekend. Oh, and don't forget to check out my new website, lasteelshow.org. It's really kind of fun. Got a whole lot of stuff going on.